Testing 1, 2, 3. This is the first part of that professor's speech on peace, security, and environment. And the in cue is... I don't know what it is. In 3, 2, 1.
I think that something that illustrates the nature of this time in which we live, quite aside from that Chinese curse, we live in interesting times, is a remark overheard at the World Future Society Conference last year, when somebody heard an elderly gentleman, like myself, muttering in the hallway, and he said, "The future is not what it used to be." And it's true that change has accelerated so immensely that we can hardly sense it, let alone understand, respond, anticipate, mediate, regulate. In fact, as Marshall McLuhan has said, the leaders of this world are still steering society through the rear view mirror. Everything is instantized. History is instantized. I have the experience of teaching a course here at Langara, and all the material I prepared earlier this year is dated. It's quite phenomenal. In this century alone, in the 89 years of this century, such unbelievable changes have occurred. We've unraveled the mysteries of the basic element of heredity, the genetic atom, deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA. We have covered this planet with an obscene overkill and overskill of nuclear arsenals so that we can strike any square yard and obliterate it. In fact, just a few months ago, to show you the kind of changes, not only do we have test tube babies, but we're on the verge of ice cube babies. Because you know there was a court case between a husband and a wife over who owns an embryo. I'm glad the woman won. That's not normal in our courts. But I suppose Hollywood, I predict that by next year there will be a film, "Honey, I Thawed the Kids." That's how quick it happens. And yet all these miraculous changes that have occurred in this 89 years of this, perhaps the last century of life on this planet, because that's one thing we have done. We've invented multiple means to our own end. We now have the means to commit omnicide, not just genocide, which we've already committed, not just cultural genocide, which we commit against the indigenous peoples of this world, but omnicide, the death of the planet, the murder of the planet. These profound changes, which are so intriguing, are such that two Russian words, particularly one Russian word, perestroika, has become a word for all seasons, a word for all reasons, a word for the world. And it amuses me and saddens me that we may have genuine glee that this phenomena is taking place in Eastern Europe in some kind of blindness that it is our world as well, equally, that requires this restructuring. Because it is our world that has, in its cunning and inventiveness, created the perils that now beset all life on this planet. And without restructuring, we are slowly committing suicide. Let me just show you what the world looks like in terms of a fundamental issue. Because above all motivations that have driven history, human history, none is so powerful, none is so commanding, none is so demanding as the loss of justice, as injustice. That's the driving force of political change. And as long as there is rampant injustice, we will have, unfortunately, the violence that is the consequence of injustice. You just look at this. Look at this world in which we live. This world in which we avow verbally the principles of the United Nations. Human rights, universal human rights. Can you see it? So here we have, we privileged people consume 3/4 of all the resources in this world, all the energy, all the steel, all the iron, all the copper, all the aluminum, all the water, 3/4 of it, 1/4, eh? Can you imagine now if people from the third world were to say, quite legitimately, we will stop polluting the environment. We will express this concern, this new concern, this new greening of the world, this new alleged greening of the world, because all that glitters is not merely the green of land that's blooming. Unfortunately, it's also the green of money. What if they said, when we are consuming our fair share as defined by the average Canadian, then we will share your concern? That's a perfectly legitimate request. Why not? Everybody has that right. Everybody has the right to seek the so-called, the alleged good things of life. Then I made a calculation. The effective world population in terms of consumption would be not 5.5 billion, but closer to 30 billion in terms of consumption. An impossible situation. Impossible. And there's good news and bad news about the World Commission on Environment and Development, also known as the Brundtland Report, published in 1987 by the United Nations, a document that has affected and infected the world, and in a good way, because it occurred at a time in history of a strange turnaround, the waning of the Cold War. The Cold War is literally dead, except for some people who won't let it die. And the world is being restructured whether we want it or not, because in the new world, the United States will be the third most powerful economic country in the world. Japan and the new Europe of the 90s will be more powerful economically for the first time in history, significantly more powerful than the United States. This will have a great geopolitical impact on the United States and on the world. The Soviet Union, if it's not bankrupt by either design or the inability to correct the terrible problems, and it's beset by incredible problems, economic problems, if the Soviet Union can get out of the arms race, it may have a chance. But even then, the Soviet Union will be a fifth or sixth rate power in this restructured world. This will have an immense impact. These are the new megatrends. We're witnessing, in some ways, a second stage of the death of ideology. Ideologies are becoming merged one into the other, at least in a superficial way, if not in a profound or fundamental way. And also there is, unfortunately, a shared ideology of progress. And I believe it's that ideology of progress, with its omniscient rationality, with its instrumentalism, its linear reductionist mode of thinking, that has created the terrible backlashes that we face and that's expressed by this kind of world. I want to talk very briefly about ideas of security. The concept of security in our century has been monopolized by another word attached to it, military security, which of course has under that umbrella economic and social security. But it's been expressed in terms of what the poet W.H. Auden said, an outrageous novelty has been introduced into the world, and now it seems everything that we had learnt before has no meaning, and those are the nuclear arsenals that still confront us, and still the world could end, if not with a bang, with a whimper. Security has been built around military power, and the assumptions of peace through strength has created its own dynamics of a terrible arms race, an arms race that the British economist really said the most telling thing about, that bad money drives out good, so that all the money we need for the future, for our children, for education, for health, for equity, is driven out by the bad money of weapons, plunder, the pirates of the world, the exploiters, and we can't find the money to do the things for survival that we really want to do. So security has been focused on alliances, military alliances, on military power. And I heard the phrase many years ago, but I thought it was a perceptive phrase, a concept called common security. Is there some way, as in science fiction, often, that we think of ourselves as planetary people, that we think of ourselves as kinfolk, that we have kinship, that we are on a single spaceship on a long voyage through space and time? Is there some way that that can come about, that incredible revolution of thought and hope? And in science fiction, it does often through the scenes whereby the planet is threatened. The planet is threatened as a whole, and all the divisive forces of the planet realizing that it's the only way to have a win-win game. Every other game is a sum-zero game. Every power game is a sum-zero game. The only game in which everybody can win is if we complete this 5 billion voyage on this incredible spaceship.
And this is the second part of the speech at Langara College in 3, 2, 1.
The sources of insecurity are obviously the rampant injustice. For me, those figures about the third world are a fundamental numerology of injustice. And also, they're the causes of conflict. They're the sources of conflict. And they're intimately connected to the destruction of the environment. If you look at where conflict is occurring in the third world, it is so often ecologically interrelated with environmental degradation, destruction. That's why this concept of a fourth world is a valuable concept. Let me just briefly talk about what I have now come to identify as five worlds in which we live. We all know that the first and second worlds are the so-called economically developed countries of this world, mainly the countries of Eastern Europe and the countries of Western Europe, Canada, United States, Japan, etc. And we call those the first and second world, the first naturally self-identified as the so-called capitalist world, free enterprise world, and so on. And the communist, in quotes, or socialist world, if you will, in quotes, capitalist should be in quotes too. There's no such thing as any of those societies in its pure sense. Those are the first two. The third world we know is now, we used to say, the undeveloped, and we realized what an error we had made, and we talk about the developing world, the third world. And those were the statistics of the third world that I showed you. But fascinatingly enough, there is a fourth world. The fourth world is composed of peoples, peoples. They are nations, but unfortunately they are not nation states. They are often struggling for national identity. They're almost always struggling for recognition, for some kind of sovereignty, even over the use of their lands, even over the preservation of their culture. There are 25,000 such peoples in the world. There are about a billion of such peoples in the world. In the Brazilian rainforest alone, in the Brazilian rainforest, there are 400 peoples, all of whom have a unique language, a unique geographical territory, a unique lifestyle, a unique religion, a unique culture. And when they cut down the trees, they're committing cultural genocide. And that more violence, I mean, all they're doing now is murdering the leaders, of indigenous peoples, murdering the rubber workers who have organized the rubber workers against the incredible slaughter of the trees. So 400. There's the division in Ethiopia between two peoples, dominant and subdominant. There are the Kurds in Iraq. Africa is beset by conflicts between peoples, tribal warfare. And let's not delude ourselves. You know, we live in a global village, but most of us are also tribal peoples. All you have to do is look at what's going on in Northern Ireland to see tribalism. All you have to do is look what's going on in the Middle East to see how people can be driven by fundamentalist views to mindless killing and destruction. So that's the fourth world. That's now the major source of refugees. We now have ecological refugees. There are now several million ecological refugees. People driven off by the colonial onslaught on nature by the developed world. So that's our fourth world. I was saddened, as I said, I started to say this, and I'm going to backtrack, when I realized how cosmetic, in its worst sense, was our common future. That's the World Commission on Environment and Development. How it became a bandwagon. How it rose to the top of the hit parade of global issues. Sustainable development. Played by those impossible figures, if you know their record. Mrs. Thatcher, Brian Mulroney. People dedicated, systemically dedicated, part of a system of mindless growth, playing that particular song. The phrase itself is a trap, a conceptual trap, because there is no such thing. There can't be. It's a violation of fundamental laws of nature. You can't sustain growth. You'd have to redefine development, because as it's defined in the narrow region of economic development, which is more of the same, more or less. So it's a kind of a reformist view of how the world might save itself. But the world won't save itself by reform. It's too late. It's unfortunate that this powerful document should have had those negative connotations. You know, the laws of entropy are so pervasive and powerful, and you've got to live by them. You've got to create social systems and economic systems. You know, entropy says something very simple in common language. It says in energy transfers to create work, you can't win. Law number one, you must lose. Law number two. Law number three, there is no other game. So this delusion that we can maintain growth in that sense of the traditional understanding of what growth and development are is a dangerous delusion. On the other hand, that document has come at a wonderful time because it's helped to organize people. It's helped to create new consensus of ideas. It's helped to move huge networks. It's helped to change policies. It's led maybe more powerfully than any other event to what we call municipal empowerment. So you have this phenomena which is part now of what I've come to call the fifth world, the emerging world that's planetary in scope, that's planetary in ethics, that's planetary about how it operates the spaceship for the long voyage. It's happening in the ecology of grassroots among ordinary people. And because cities and municipalities are the most democratic of all our jurisdictions, our political jurisdictions, because we have direct or more direct access to the politics at the municipal level, cities are doing remarkable things. Cities quietly have divested. Even while the Reagan government was playing a kind of quiet diplomacy footsie with South Africa, cities were divesting. All investments in South Africa were withdrawn, or companies that were in South Africa were withdrawn. Cities now have purchasing programs. They will not purchase anything used by the city from one of the major arms suppliers. Cities are now conducting foreign policy and diplomacy by twinning, by becoming sister cities. And at the same time that that's happening, people have become empowered. Individual citizens have become empowered. And citizens now are engaging in diplomacy. It's a marvelous thing that's happening. It's a new awakening. It's the first birth of a higher level of democracy. Not the democracy that's clamored for at the square in Tiananmen or in the streets of Hungary or Poland, but a participatory democracy and an anticipatory democracy. A democracy that makes us stewards of the spaceship and stewards of the environment and resources. That's happening. There's a black and dark side of the fifth world. Because at the same time, the fifth world is made up by two of the biggest businesses in the world. The arms trade, particularly no-name brand arms, which fuel and feed all the wars in the world. And the drug trade. Two clandestine kind of economies existing and coexisting with the formal traditional economies of the corporations and the multinationals and the transnationals. And so again, the transnationals are part of the fifth world. The United Nations is the precursor of government in the fifth world. Amnesty International and Oxfam and peacekeeping forces. Some of those have already been recognized by the United Nations and given the Nobel Prize for Peace. They are part of the fifth world. So the fifth world is still in struggle. But it is emerging and it is hopeful.
Part three in 3, 2, 1.
Remember we talked about part of the fifth world being two major underground economies, the drug economy and the arms economy. And I saw a documentary I just want to share because I think it's a fascinating answer perhaps to the drug problem. One answer. It was an interview with the warlord of the Shan people who live in a triangle bordered by Thailand, Burma, and Laos. Okay? It's called the Golden Triangle. Produces 70% of the world's heroin. Okay? And he was saying, there is a way to stop this. I'm prepared to cooperate. He is treated like a demigod because they have been fighting a war. They're one of the peoples I talked about. They're part of the fourth world. They've been fighting a war for recognition, sovereignty, status, cultural integrity, okay? He said, our people, the people who grow the poppies, are not addicts. As far as I know, we have none. He said, I'm willing to guarantee a 15% annual reduction in the production of the poppies who are then processed various stages until we have that white, deadly demon powder, okay? Or liquid, if you're going to shoot it. And he said, in 6 years, we will be to zero production, cutting out 70% of the world's production of heroin. And what do I want in return for it? I want you to buy the product for those 6 years, 100% to begin with, 85% next year, 70% the next year, down to zero. I want you to buy it. I want you, the United States, or the Western world, to buy it so that my people who live on this, who have no alternative as of now, because you're also talking now about an equity issue, about people who are living off a terrible product, maybe not that worse than many products like dioxin and so on that we have liberated into our environment, but of high profile, okay? He said, I want also for you to give us an alternative, a non-drug agriculture. Come and teach us to grow useful, nutritious things in those 6 years. And we will convert from a drug culture to an agriculture. Now, I thought this is an incredible idea because that's part of the problem. What I was saying earlier, that as long as you have this gross social debt between the poor and the rich, between the dispossessed and the possessed, you will drive these issues that lead to violence and conflict. And we have to sort those issues out to find this extended common security which covers human rights, universal human rights for every fellow traveler on this spaceship Earth, which protects the environment for the long, long future, and which prevents a nuclear holocaust and hopefully war itself. I want to talk to you about Gaia. See, what one of the things Gaia might, and Gaia did talk to me, incidentally. I have these imaginary conversations. I sometimes have them with a stone. I had one with a crow the other day. I was going to a meeting, luncheon meeting, and the crow talked to me and said some very, very amusing things to me, and I had a little bit of a conversation with it, and afterwards I said, God, crows can't talk. Well, they can. But, you know, that was an intelligent conversation. I must be going crazy. But nevertheless, I'm now talking to Gaia. And one of the things Gaia said to me is, you're a man, aren't you? I said, I suppose I am androgynous, but I won't go into that. She said, why do you people use the collective mankind? She said, look at my friends. Look at those beautiful deer. They don't call them stag kind, you know? She said, you have a very strange way of looking at things. For example, you call your economic activities production and consumption. What you call production, we call consumption, because you're consuming ecological goods. You're consuming ecological services. And what you call consumption, we call production. We are producing for you. We are recycling, not just garbage. We're recycling everything. Everything that's living in nature, we're recycling. Gaia said, your economics is strange because you call these things air, water, and soil, and earth. You call them free goods. You externalize them. You don't count them in your accounting systems. Your world is run by accountants. You know, accountants suffer from exponential myopia. This is not possible. And Gaia said, you run the world by laws. Laws made mainly by men in courts. But the world doesn't run on laws. Laws is not laws of humans. Don't make the world turn and go. It's the laws of nature. Those are our laws. And so on, this conversation between Gaia and you talked about a redesigned world, a restructured world, not a retrofit world. We build an automobile and we build it in a black box by a design engineer, and then we discover that the exhausts are not confined to the black box. You know, they pollute our air. They cause lead poisoning. They emit some hydrocarbons that are carcinogenic. So then we add something onto the exhaust of the automobiles, and we say we solved the problem because we've cut air pollution in half. And then the automobiles double in population and we're back where we started from because we don't understand exponential growth. She said, just copy us. She said, everything we use is designed for reuse, is designed to be recycled over and over again. You can design products like that. You don't have to have either waste, pollution, or depletion. And so on. A fascinating thought. I want to ask everybody a question, because I think one of our problems is that we and our institutions have been programmed to have an inability to defer gratification. We want it now. We want more. We want it bigger. And all the problems in the world cannot be solved by maximization or by the continual subversion of quality by quantity. There is no real debate between growth and non-growth. It's that we're using the wrong terms to measure growth. There is one exponential alive in this world, and that's in here. It's the exponential of the imagination. It's the exponential of our human evolution and growth. And we may be going through an evolutionary period. Stephen Gould thinks we are. We may be going through a revolution of evolution, because that's the only way we're going to survive if we go through that. So the questions one should ask is, how far in space and time is the radius of your real caring? Not your nominal, alleged caring, but the caring backed up by commitment, operationalized by your acts and your actions. How far? Just to your community? To your family? To your religion? To tomorrow? To next year? To your children? To your grandchildren? To your grandchildren's grandchildren? It's a terribly important question, because right now, we have mortgaged the future. And we may say we love our children, and we may manifest that love by a large inheritance. We may leave them a lot of property. We may buy educational insurance. But we're poisoning their world. If you love your children and if you love this planet, you will stop poisoning it and manifest your love in the only true way, by living not just for the present, but for the future. Thank you very much.